Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September 15th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Evelyn Strang, and she will be speaking on celebrating the creation. All life is holy. Let's listen in.
Everything was so much centered around humans that the rest of the natural world was pretty much exploited. And so we've had some discussions about that. Maya Angelou read a poem at the last inauguration, and I was out of the country somewhere and didn't hear it. But I have a copy of that, part of it, and I think this sort of reviews what we have said in the last few days and sort of sets the tone. A rock, a river, a tree, host to species long since departed, marked the mastodon. The dinosaur, who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor. Any broad alarm of their hastening doom is lost in the gloom of dust and ages. But today, the rock cries out to us, clearly, forcefully. Come, you may stand upon my back and face your distant destiny, but seek no haven in my shadow. I will give you no hiding place down here. You, created only a little lower than the angels, have crouched too long in the bruising darkness, have lain too long face down in ignorance, your mouths spilling words. Armed for slaughter, the rock cries out to us today. You may stand on me, but do not hide your face. Across the wall of the world, a river sings a beautiful song. It says, come rest here by my side. Each of you a bordered country, delicately and strangely made proud, yet thrusting perpetually under siege, your armed struggles for profit have left collars of waste upon my shore, currents of debris upon my breast. Yet today I call you to my riverside, if you will study war no more. Come, clad in peace, and I will sing the songs the Creator gave to me, when I and the tree and the rock were one, before cynicism was a bloody sear across your brow, and when yet you knew, still knew nothing, the river sings and sings on. Well, that's part of Maya Angelou's poem, which is the idea of what's happening to the environment, the rock, the river, and the tree. Things long departed, and yet they're part of the creation. What is the attitude towards the creation, and is there anything in Scripture that helps us? I must tell you a little story, which you may have heard, but maybe I heard this at first at Holden. I'm not sure. There was this guy who was an outdoors person who went into a forest and shot a spotted owl. And that had been detected, that he shot the spotted owl. And so it was reported and it was seen. So when the ranger caught up with him, he couldn't find the evidence. I mean, where is the spotted owl? They knew he'd shot the spotted owl. And the ranger asked, well, where's the spotted owl? He says, oh, I ate it. The ranger was pretty upset because he'd eaten the evidence. But out of curiosity, he asked, well, how did it taste? He said, well, the taste was somewhere between that of a golden eagle and a whooping crane. Anyway, the attitude towards living things. And in the Northwest, of course, the spotted owl has become a symbol of something that is perhaps overly protected over against the livelihood of loggers and so on. Any comment on that from anybody from the Northwest? I mean, is that still simmering or is it about to be settled?
It's simmering.
It's still simmering, yes. So sometimes it seems that the life of one particular kind of creature in the natural environment is pitted against human economic situations. And the answers are not easy. And I think we are well aware that the Bible is not an answer book for all questions. I mean, we misuse scripture if we try to make it an answer book. But are there any attitudes towards living things that we might find in scripture? Any guidelines? So let's look at a few things. The Noah's Ark story. All right, now how you take the story and so on. When I went to Turkey this summer, someone asked me if I'd gotten to Mount Ararat to see the ruins of the Ark up there. Well, I said, I guess I don't take the ruins of the Ark too seriously. I mean, if somebody has found them, whatever. I mean, the point of the story. Now, is there anything in the Genesis story? Thank you, Howard, for getting the rest of the Bibles here. In Genesis chapter 7, you know, all the charming little things that they have for children. In fact, I had a granddaughter who had a baby shower, and she chose as her theme Noah's Ark. You know, they have these themes now for baby showers and whatnot, and then the nursery was decorated in Noah's Ark animals. I mean, how many Noah's Ark things have you seen in primary Sunday school rooms? I mean, they're just all over the place. But look at the story, and look at, in chapter 7, what is the purpose of all of these animals, pairs of animals, in the ark. We won't read all of this, but the end of verse 3 says what?
Do this so that every kind of animal and bird will be kept alive to reproduce again on the earth.
All right. To keep their kind alive. So it seems, from this story, that it was not only Noah and Noah's family that were important, but also the living creatures, the animals, to keep their kind alive. Well, that's what it says in part of the old story here. Now, the keep their kind alive in the midst of destruction. If we go on to chapter 9, the first few verses, and there is a covenant made in chapter 9. And especially around verses 9 and 10. And I'm assuming you're all Bible scholars and are familiar with this. I mean, so you have the reference in here. This is after the flood. But look at the covenant in verses 9 and 10. Will someone read that, please?
Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark.
Thank you. The covenant is not just with humankind. The covenant is with all the living things in there, that are in there. That they, according to what the story suggests, that these two are important to the Creator. However you take the story, they also seem to be important to the Creator, all the different kinds of creatures. Now we have something about plants coming in there too, but verses 2, I think that...
If you look up in verses 2 and 3...
Yes, 2 and 3. Would you read that, please?
All the animals, birds, and fish will live in fear of you. They are all placed under your power. Now you can eat them as well as many plants. I give them all to you for food.
You know, that's a very interesting thing. Because in Genesis 1, we read that plants are for food. And around Holden, we have people who take vegetarianism very seriously. I have two daughters-in-law and two adult granddaughters who are vegetarians by choice. And so if you could stay with Genesis 1 and say, God gave people plants for food. This is interesting. After the flood, after sin comes into the world, then they start eating meat. So you can make a good point. If you're making a strong case for vegetarianism, I guess you could quote this. But the interesting thing here that the living things might be fearing people. After sin comes into the world, into your hand they are delivered. Everything that lives shall be food for you. But it is freeing human beings to use all things for food, animals and so on, also, I think. Any comment on that, on the food thing?
You know, I've missed quite a bit of this, but you're speaking a lot.
All right, we're looking at the context of living things, and what are the attitudes that we might find in some scripture passages towards living things beyond human beings? Is there any guideline in any of this that might help us as human beings know how to make decisions about living things? And whether we can make the wise decision about the spotted owl in the Northwest. I mean, as we said, it's not an answer book, but I mean, are there guidelines in scripture or at least indications? And that's what we're looking for.
You know, this is really a think tank, isn't
yes.
it? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's sort of designed like this, a covenant mm-hmm. for all life. Now, the geological record, and I do a little dabbling in geology, and next week, Lord willing, I'll do some geological programs. The geological record shows that there are more species that are extinct than are living today.
Oh.
I mean, all the different kinds of fossils you find in the record of creatures that are no longer with us. I mean, notably the big ones like the dinosaurs and saber-toothed tigers and mastodons and mammoths, the Ice Age, big Ice Age mammals, and giant armadillos. There really were giant armadillos in Texas and other places and so on. A lot of things have gone extinct. So this raises the question of, is extinction something that happens anyway? And is it the Creator's will that they should all keep on living? I mean, if everything that ever was alive would be still alive, I mean, all the species.
Or is extinction part of of God's plan and purpose? Part of the cycle?
It happens.
Right.
It happens.
However, if we follow that logic and say, therefore, oh, well, who cares about the spotted owl? Let's make it extinct. Then we begin to tamper with the harmony and balance of creation, and we get ourselves in really big trouble.
Yeah. As Joe Sittler said, and I quoted this the other day, that the whole relationship in nature is like a spider web. You touch one little part of it, of a spider web, and the whole thing quivers, kind of thing. And Joe Sittler was one of the early Christian teachers who really got into ecology back in early 70s or earlier than that. Yes. So attitudes towards living things the creation was good. I read something from Annie Dillard the other day and mentioned Annie Dillard's book, A Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which is a marvelous celebration of very small creatures. And in there she has a section saying, though, there's some little creatures you wonder what earthly good were they? I mean, it's just that the idea that the Creator must have had a blast just thinking up these weird things. Which serve no particular purpose, I mean, but as far as human beings can see.
Right. I think that's real interesting, and I think that idea that we judge all living things by their utilitarian value to us, instead of what Annie's trying to say is that they have a right to exist for their own sake, we even know they exist or not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or they're in the food chain. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, and sometimes we don't really know about some of these things till they're discovered later on. Well, in the previous session here, there was a lot of discussion about agriculture, sustainable agriculture, and livestock, cattle, and so on. Treatment of livestock. And there are some people who are not real comfortable with mass production of chickens, for example, that never set foot on ground.
No.
And there's that's some of that's done in my part of the country, as you know, we're down where you used to be. I mean, chicken, I mean, they never see the daylight. They see the daylight when they come in on trucks to Holly Farms in Seguin. I mean, that's when the chickens see the daylight on the trucks, and that's it. I mean, kind of livestock, which has been, and of course the larger animals. Did you see Babe, any of you, the movie? I recommended it. Maybe a children's, the Lutheran recommends it. Yes. Babe may be a children's story. It's set up as a children's story, but it does deal with the treatment of, in this case, hogs, and raises some questions. Out of Australia, a charming story. Well, anyway, livestock, Deuteronomy, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy 25. They had livestock back then. And in chapter 25 is a classic quotation that is also picked up in the New Testament. Verse 4 in Deuteronomy 25. Anyone have that?
You shall not muzzle out an ox when it treads out the grain.
Okay. How are they using the oxen?
Threshing machine.
Sort of like a threshing machine, right. And this poor ox is working, and is hungry. There's an attitude, right, towards concern for this poor animal. I mean, it's okay to work the animal, but at least care about it. And that, we, you know, I think I may have it on that sheet, but that is repeated in 1 Corinthians. Paul uses it about don't muzzle the ox that is treading out the grain. The verse is slightly different, but if you want the reference, we can look it up. All right, and then Exodus, I guess we should go backwards here. Chapter 20, you recognize that as the one with the commandments. Exodus 20, and where we have the one about the Sabbath day. Somebody read that, please. Exodus 20, about verses 8 and the following.
Did you say 23?
Exodus chapter 20, verse 8, and the following verses there. Thank you. Remember the Sabbath day, okay?
Somebody hit the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your manservant or your maidservant or your cattle or the sojourner who is within your gates.
Thank you.
6 days.
Yeah, yeah, and so on. Mm-hmm. But concern also for the livestock. Mm-hmm. Don't work the poor animals to death. They also deserve a time of rest, which is an attitude in here that the Hebrew people were encouraged to have, and attitudes towards respect for livestock. That also is in Deuteronomy. Well, you would expect it to be repeated in Deuteronomy, a lot of these things. So it's not, it's, you know, and there are several times. While we're in Exodus, let's look at chapter 23. And there, verses 4 and 5 of Exodus, chapter 23, 4 and 5. Someone share that, please.
If thou meet thine enemy's ox or his ass going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If thou see the ass of him that hateth thee lying under his burden, and wouldst forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help with him.
All right, there's something about helping him to lift it up, right, on the burden. Now, part of that is the lost animal. I mean, part of that is an attitude towards even your enemy. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if your enemy's horse has wandered off or something, you should even, you know, care for the animal to return it to its owner. Because if it
if it wanders off by itself, it could get in worse trouble, perhaps, right? Might not get any food or something like that. How do you see the one in verse 5? Jan, you're good at interpretation. You have any insight on that?
23:5, you were saying?
That verse 5, yeah. Are you seeing that as the helping relieve the animal of the burden?
That's what I'm seeing.
That's what. Yeah. Anybody else on that?
Well, it tells you.
It suggests.
I said it tells you to help him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it's relieving the animal of the burden to some extent.
It seems to imply the Hebrew's kind of obscure there, so.
Yeah, it's all right. It's not real clear, but it seems like you care about this animal. All right. Deuteronomy, we'll move on ahead again to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Genesis, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy chapter 22. And around verse 6 in verse 6. Well, it's 6 and 7. Deuteronomy 22, 6 and 7.
If you chance to come upon a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground, with young ones or eggs and a mother sitting upon the young or upon the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take to yourself, that it may go well with you and that you may live long.
Okay. Maybe there's a nest of quail or something that someone has spotted. But maybe you can eat the nice, young, tender quail, but think about the next generation, maybe.
I'm not sure
it makes a lot of sense.
That's true.
I mean, you need the young. I know. Right. Yeah.
You should not take the mother with you. Until they're old enough to take care of themselves, and then you can take the mother, but not the young. Or the young. But
that's right.
But if you take the mother, you probably lose the whole batch.
That's right.
Yeah.
Depends on their age, I guess. But it's a strange.
Yeah.
Well, it's also saying that you might be taking the egg, the young or the egg, so if you want the egg.
Young ones or eggs, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one. But whatever, there's a little bit of concern for the birds, too. I mean, just don't wipe out the whole situation, all right? Verse 10 has another verse that's quoted often. Somebody have that?
Oh, it says, thou shalt not plow with an ox.
And an ass?
Yes.
Together.
Right.
Well, now, now that obviously isn't applying to us. We're not plying with animals. What would be the situation?
They're so unevenly balanced.
Would be hard on the animals, right? I think it'd be a real struggle. I mean, I can see that donkey being real stubborn in there, and the poor ox maybe, and you know what?
The ox, and the ox would gore the donkey.
Yeah. So it's just good common sense not to do that, right? Now there are a lot of other things in here that we don't do or we don't take seriously. Like, I mean, don't mix some kinds of fibers and things like that. But we're looking at, are there any attitudes towards animals, living things, and so on in there. Hosea, we have to go a little farther in our Bibles here, right? And never be embarrassed to use your index. Real close to Daniel. You know, just because I memorized the books of the Bible in confirmation a long time ago, I don't usually repeat those every day that way. I don't mind using my index if I need to. All right, in Hosea, towards the end of the Old Testament, chapter 2, verses 18 through 20. It's another covenant kind of thing that we have here. Verses 18 through 20 in chapter 2 of Hosea. Someone read that for us, please.
At that time, I will make a covenant with all the wild animals and birds so that they will not harm my people. I will also remove all weapons of war from the land, all swords and bows, and will let my people live in peace and safety. Israel, I will make you my wife. I will be true and faithful. I will show you constant love and mercy and make you mine forever. I will keep my promise and make you mine.
Thank you. That's one of those wonderful covenant, hopeful things looking ahead. But who all is in the covenant? Not only people, but...
the birds and the creeping things.
Yeah, right. So the other creatures are in there also. All right, it's just neat to find some of these little things. I'm sure you can search the scriptures and find some more references like this, but they're inklings, they're attitudes that are suggested here. Now, the Christian scriptures do also have some attitudes. For example, in Matthew chapter 12, and that's one you'll recognize right away. Matthew 12, verse 11. And this is given here as a quotation from Jesus. And it's in question of healing on the Sabbath. You know, where Jesus is asked about, you know, healing somebody on the Sabbath because Jesus has just done it. And so what does he say in verse 11 according to this?
He said to them, what man of you, if he has one sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out?
Right, right. Now, of course, the next verse is saying that the human being has more value than the sheep. But the concern for the animal and the welfare of the animal is more important than the Sabbath day. And the same thing is in Luke, only in Luke it's an ox or a donkey, depending on how it's translated. So the same story told in a different way, that the welfare of the animal is more important than keeping this religious, regulation kind of thing. Now, there are some things about plants. We're talking about living things. I think in the New Testament, there are not a lot of references, but surely, in the Sermon on the Mount, in chapter 6, for example, of Matthew, verses 26 through 29. All right, Sermon on the Mount, obviously a compilation of different sermons, but if you've been to Israel, they'll show you the Mount of the Beatitudes, and you can well see Jesus sitting someplace on this hillside overlooking the Lake of Galilee and perhaps some of the teaching there. You can see the setting. It's outdoors. There are flowers. There are birds around and whatnot. And when Jesus is talking about not being anxious about your life and so on, what does he say? Verse 26. Matthew 6.
Look at the birds. They do not plant seeds, gather a harvest, and put it in barns. Yet your Father in heaven takes care of them. Aren't you worth much more than birds?
And please go on a little bit.
Can any of you live a bit longer by worrying about it? And why worry about clothes? Look how the wild flowers grow. They do not work or make clothes for themselves. But I tell you that not even King Solomon, with all his wealth, had clothes as beautiful as one of these flowers.
Thank you. All right, you can see the outdoor setting. Jesus is using what's out there. Look at the birds, and then uses this as an illustration. Yesterday we said how the scripture writers used their natural environment for imagery, like rocks, the stability of God, the rock higher than I. There are lots of rocks around. Water being very, very precious in a dry land. So there are a lot of references to water for imagery. And so Jesus is using birds, and look at those flowers over there, and there are pretty flowers, wildflowers there, and using them to make a point, at least to look at them. Yesterday we said something about looking at the creation, looking at the rocks, that it's almost insulting when we shut our eyes to the beauty and just ignore it. Like you drive along, there's nothing there except those old rocks along the Columbia River. Ah, this is glory of God revealed in those the basalt. Oh, well, it's just a field of wildflowers.
Did you use the quote yesterday from The Color Purple?
No, please do, but that's a good one.
How if we walk by the color purple,
right, yeah. That's a marvelous quotation that Alice Walker has.
And
yeah, how can you walk by some of those things and not notice them? So I think that's the idea. Trees are celebrated a lot in Hebrew scriptures. Psalm 1, I mean, and used as an analogy. Let's just turn to a couple of the Psalms here. Psalm 1. And you know how it begins? Right. Here is where the writer of the psalm, whoever, is using the natural environment for, and well, it may not be analogy, but for a setting or something. But blessed is the man, the person. The righteous person is like what in verse 3?
Like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers.
All right. So seeing a beautiful tree that is just doing well, that's watered well, can remind one of the good life, the goodly person that is nourished, that shows beauty and strength and perhaps productivity, fruit, whatever.
What about the scripture, though, where I think it's where Jesus talks about cutting down the tree that doesn't bear fruit?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So there are some expectation. Exactly. Yeah, and of course the fig tree, you know.
Right.
That wasn't, and it didn't even have, it wasn't even the season for figs.
But I think when we see those, we have to look beyond that immediate context to understand that maybe you can extend it to saying everything has its purpose, and when it doesn't fulfill its purpose, mm-hmm. it no longer, in a sense, has a right to its
existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if you can stretch it that far or not.
Yeah.
But.
We've used Psalm 104 one of these days this week. I had an illustrated slide presentation on excerpts from Psalm 104, but that's a good one to read again any time about this. Plants and animals. And in this case, the plants and animals in Psalm 104 are all given in context of something about which we can say thank you to God, praise to God. For the heavens, Psalm 104, for the mountain heights, the waters, the springs, the wonderful springs, the wonderful waterfalls of the Cascades, and the birds, and we don't have wild asses, but we have wild deer, and we even have bear up on trails, I hear. And of course the grass for the cattle and high mountains and so on. But the trees, all of these things are celebrated in nature. And so the idea that we thank God for these. The importance of trees in a dry land is shown in a couple of historical records here in Deuteronomy again. All right, the Middle East is pretty dry. And any trees were pretty special, and they were cultivated. And there are some guidelines on how to make war in Deuteronomy. And that is something, again, in Scripture that we have to see in context of the history. Was God telling them how to make war, or did they, in retrospect, sort of rationalize what they had been doing? But there's an interesting little thing here about in Deuteronomy 20, there, when you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace. Well, if you're fighting against it, anyway, we won't go into that. But how to handle the people. But then in about verse 19 and 20, is this about what should go on if you have to make war? Somebody read those, please.
Verse 19
19 and 20 of chapter 20 in Deuteronomy.
When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them, for you may eat of them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field men that they should be besieged by you? Only the trees which you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down, but you may build siege works against a city that makes war with you until it falls.
It's sort of an interesting context, and here we're making war. But the importance of trees, and that might be selfish in this way, because, you know, if they're going to conquer this city, they want the trees and their productivity. But trees were precious. By the way, there's one case where this was not done, and we won't take time to look that up, but in 2 Kings, there's a record of a war with Moab, and the record is that the people felled all the good trees, and that was a no-no. They weren't supposed to do that. They felled all the good trees. It's in 2 Kings someplace. Well, obviously, Scripture doesn't have all the answers for our attitude towards plants and animals. These are some little clues or some little glimpses. But I guess more and more writers are saying something like this. This is from Catherine Lacunga, who is from Notre Dame, in a book called God for Us. And this is the secondary quotation. The living God is the God who is alive in relationship, alive in communion with the creature, alive with desire for union with every creature. God is so thoroughly involved in every last detail of creation that if we could truly grasp this, it would altogether change how we approach each moment of our lives. For everything that exists, insect, agate, galaxy, manifests the mystery of the living God. Well, is that pantheism?
No.
No.
Not unless you worship all of those things.
It doesn't say that the created things are God. But that they manifest, they show evidence of them.
Mm-hmm. I don't know much about New Age and crystals, but since I am interested in geology and crystals are fascinating. In fact, I found some black quartz. I found it for sale, and I bought a beautiful chunk of black quartz for a museum display because it's sort of unusual. And when you get into crystals, there is a whole cult of people who really deal with crystals. I looked at a New Age bookstore, and there were more than 36 books on crystals that were, how to shape your life around the crystals, Well, I'm not saying they're worshiping the crystals, but their life is really pretty.
They're on the borderline.
Well, it sure looks to me like that. I did not buy any of the books, but I skimmed. I mean, the crystal itself has become so marvelous that you see the wonder in the crystal itself, and I'm not sure it's leading you to the God who designed the crystal.
God tells us that he reveals himself most clearly in Jesus Christ.
Yes, yes.
And in his word. So it depends on how you're using the crystal as to whether or not you're misusing it.
Yeah. So there is a lot going on these days in looking at nature and seeing the revelation of God in nature, which isn't the whole story. If the beauty of nature would alone convert a person, then that would be a different story. I have never been exactly there, but I've been next door to Berchtesgaden. You know where that is.
Victoria.
And you know that. In Austria.
Oh, in Austria.
And that was Hitler's place where he lived, his favorite place. Now, when you think about a person who surely was demonic in so many ways, like Hitler, had one of the most beautiful places in Europe to live. So that gorgeous natural environment, I've been close by, I mean, not right there, but that gorgeous natural environment, it's pretty as Holden, I mean, you know, apparently didn't make a new person of Hitler in terms of anything of, you know, experience. So
I recently heard that we were in Victoria, British Columbia, a while ago, and it's beautiful. Bouchard Gardens, have you ever been there?
No, but I hear it's
gorgeous.
Right. Yeah.
But I was also told that only 5% of the population in British Columbia are part of the church.
Okay.
So, I mean, beauty does not necessarily cause you to understand and appreciate and celebrate the Creator.
Yeah.
But I guess I've seen Christians also, however, who have taken the attitude, as we've been talking about, toward creation as being a thing and inanimate and something out there apart from God, so much so, that they don't know the Creator either. They may know Jesus, but they have no concept of the Trinity in terms of God as Creator. I think it goes both ways. The non-Christian, or maybe the pre-Christian, as we wish to call them, might be able to have some understanding of the presence of God, but I think, as Luther said, may not know God's first name by their, you know, relationship with creation. But I think there are a lot of Christians who may know Jesus, but have no concept of God as Creator the same way.
I think there's a lot being written. Thank you for that, Grant. I think there's a lot being written about our failure to recognize the importance of looking at the creation. Oh my goodness, the time is moving. There, this raises so many questions about how do we deal with the creation. And one really good question, since this is hunting season in the high country here, is how do we deal with, hunting, for example? And that gets to be a theological issue for some people. Well, my father was a hunter because back in those days that was meat in some lean years. I mean, whatever. And it was a sport. The Native American attitude towards hunting, I think, is a beautiful one. Walter Wangren's Crying for a Vision has a marvelous chapter, which is too long to read, but I'll lend it to someone, The Conversation of Death. He's borrowed it. The same idea is in a marvelous new book I should have brought with me, Mutant Message from Down Under. The same thing. Has anyone read that? Out of Australia. And it is someone who is dealing with the Aborigines. And in this case, the young Indian man, who Walter Wangren is telling his story, and he is, it's sort of mystical. And he is with this wolf, and the wolf is hungry. And the wolf sees some buffalo. And the buffalo are food. And so this is part of nature. This is a carnivore. And the wolf is now telling the young Indian man, now watch, pay attention. Learn this difference, that murder takes a life, but hunting receives that life as a gift. And so the circle is made stronger. Be silent. Stay here. And then Wangren goes on to tell the story, how the buffalo senses the presence of the wolf, and it's buffalo and her young, and also the bull. And so the bull calls the children, they obey. They sent their mother frightened backward looks, but they scrambled after their father. The women alone were left. This is a female wolf. The women alone were left, one taut as a bowstring, the other brutal and shambling, but both alike in that they held still and stared at one another. The buffalo cow made a deep sound, hunka. The wolf said, P, that I am here. I see, she said, I felt your coming. They did not speak for a moment. The whole snowy plains felt silent. The young man did not breathe, for each woman stood in spare reverence, not only for the other, but also for the event at hand. Life and death, and life again in a valiant exchange. This visible was the circle of the world. This was hunting, very holy. With a steadfast gaze, a wolf was asking for the life of her prey. And the great cow did not doubt that she had the choice, or where was the gift otherwise? A noble creature requested her life, and she was accounted worthy thereby, for her will and her wish were honored. The buffalo cow said, did you see my sons? The wolf said, yes. Did you take their measure? Yes. And haven't I done well in my sons? Aren't they well bred to your eye and well raised? Yes, said the wolf. They shall bring glory to their mother as long as they live, and they shall raise their own children with her spirit. Yes, yes, their lives shall surely honor me. My love is in them. It is good. Yes, yes. Thus did the cow herself conclude the conversation of death. And then there is a fight. The buffalo does not give in. I mean, there is a fight, but, and the buffalo cow dies. She murmured, ha ha, she knew she was not ignorant, even in the instant of her death. And then she died. The hunt was over. Now the wolf then has food, and the young man has food. But the wolf said, it had come home. It is more than I can eat. So they called the wolverines and the buzzards and the magpies, the coyotes, and even the tiny bull, and so on. And they were eating. And then the young man says, but didn't the buffalo fight not to die? How can that be a gift? The wolf said, she did not fight the dying. She fought me. She fought very well, the measure of a worthy life. No, it is not the hunt which is sinful, but the manner of hunting. Ask the hunted. Ask her by her name, and obey the answer. So the circle is whole and holy, just so. According to Walter Wangren, in the Lakota and in other, well, and I've heard George Tinker say this too, that the person who is killing an animal for meat asks that animal's permission for its life, to sustain his life. The Aborigines of Australia in this book do the same thing. If they're killing something, some little creature, even a little lizard or whatever they can find to eat out there, they will ask its permission, kind of thing. It's not eating of food, but someone has told me that the Lakota, in quarrying the catlinite, that's the sort of soapstone rock that they use for their pipes, their peace pipes, they will have a prayer before they take it from the earth. The idea of respecting the life of the other, which you may need to sustain your own life. So there's a lot in Native American spirituality, I think, about an attitude towards living things that we again are looking at.
I think it's part of it has to do with how you understand in the beginning when God said that we should have dominion.
Right.
Oh. Some people think that means dominance, right. But that is not a correct interpretation of the Hebrew concept.
Right. Would you translate that for us as you translate? Because we've done that earlier this week, and I'd like to hear yours. Great. How do you translate?
I believe it means dominion means to have responsibility for it.
Great.
To care for. And to care for means to be, to ask permission, to take care of, not to simply treat as if it has no life and no place, but to treat it with respect. To give it its own dignity.
Thank you. Yes, earlier it said that's to care tenderly for, compassionate shepherding, whatever, that kind of attitude towards life. That may not help us with the spotted owls and the loggers. Or does it? In central Texas, around Austin and close to where I live, the golden-cheeked warbler, which is on the endangered species list, which makes its nest in old cedar. And so now there are people who want to tell ranchers, you should not cut the old cedar because that's the only place the golden-cheeked warbler can nest. And there are ranchers who will get up in arms and say, nobody is going to tell me what I can do with my own land and what tree I can cut and what I can't.